It's really good to see you all. It's really great to be back. You, most of you don't change at all. You know, we come back and you look exactly the same, you know, with some exceptions. You know, Wyatt and Abe, they get more and more handsome each year, you know. But most of you, you just stay the same. It's amazing, you know, come back and it feels like we never left. One of the fun things about coming back at this stage in learning a new language is that you get to tell fun stories about language bloopers, right? Of which there are a lot. Carol and I don't think have made any such disastrous mistake as this. The woman who was learning Turkish who walked into a bakery and said, "Please, may I have two fresh young men?" I mean, yeah, it's quite allowable. Erkek and ekmek, you know? I mean, you're gonna do this, right? But we have, you know, even 2 years into this, we were just leaving, and both of us on the same day said independently to someone, we were really excited, and we said, "Oh, we are, you know, this is such a great day, we're so excited, our grandbaby was born tomorrow." No, I mean, yesterday, tomorrow, what's the difference, really? And we're always getting confused about coming and going. You know, you're just a little bit too close. You know, so, but the biggest problem with language learning at this stage, well, at every stage, is so often you're completely clueless about what's going on. You know, you're in this situation where it should be easy, people are talking, they might even be talking clearly for all you know, and you just don't know what's going on. And to be honest, you know, it just magnifies my own natural cluelessness. I mean, I'm clueless enough in English. You know, most of the time, I really don't have all that much idea what's going on. And so being in Turkey, you know, I just go around not knowing what's going on all the time. But what gives me actually great comfort this morning is that the great apostle, the great founder of the church, seem to suffer from the same condition. Luke chapter 9. Please turn there with me. Luke chapter 9, we'll begin in verse 28. About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. Now, this is really odd. I mean, Peter's response here is really odd. Put yourself in Peter's shoes. It isn't all that long ago. It's a few days ago that Peter announced publicly in response to Jesus' question when he said, "Who do people say that I am, and who do you say that I am?" Peter said, "You're God's Messiah." You know, he announces it, he knows who Jesus is. And he's on this mountain with the inner circle of Jesus, and Jesus' glory has just been revealed to him. You know, there's this blinding light coming from Jesus. He knows he's the Messiah, there's this blinding light, and what's his response? "Let's go camping." You know, this is his response. "Let's set up some shelters here." You know, this seems really random. It seems really off the wall. It seems too random even for Peter. Where does he get this idea of setting up shelters? Well, it turns out we know exactly where he gets this idea for setting up shelters. Turn back in the Bible to the book of Leviticus, Leviticus chapter 23. In Leviticus chapter 23, beginning in verse 33, we read this. "The Lord said to Moses, 'Say to the Israelites, on the 15th day of the seventh month of the Lord's, on the 15th day of the seventh month, the Lord's Feast of Tabernacles begins, and it lasts for 7 days. The first day is a sacred assembly. Do no regular work. For 7 days, present offerings made to the Lord by fire. On the eighth day, hold a sacred assembly and present an offering made to the Lord by fire. It is the closing assembly. Do no regular work. Let's skip down to verse 39. So beginning with the 15th day of the seventh month, after you have gathered the crops of the land, celebrate the festival to the Lord for 7 days. The first day is a day of rest, and the eighth day also is a day of rest. On the first day, you are to take choice fruit from the trees and palm fronds, leafy branches and poplars, and rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. Celebrate this as a festival to the Lord for 7 days each year. This is to be a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. Celebrate it in the seventh month. Live in booths for 7 days. All native-born Israelites are to live in booths. So your descendants will know that I had the Israelites live in booths when I brought them out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So this whole event, the transfiguration, takes place during the Feast of Tabernacles that we've just read about, also called the Feast of Booths, also called Sukkot. It comes 5 days after the Day of Atonement. Right? And the Feast of Tabernacles is one of the three big Jewish festivals during the year. So this is, this seems to be deliberately chosen by Jesus. This is when this is going to happen. It's during the Feast of Tabernacles. What is the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, the signature mark, the signature activity of the Feast of Tabernacles is you set up these little tabernacles. You set up these little booths. And these booths have to have leafy coverings to them, right? That's what you make as the roof. You can have any kind of siding you want. You can have aluminum siding if you want, but you have to have booths. You have to have leaves over your head. What's this about? Well, it has three purposes, actually, three intertwined purposes. The first is it's a remembrance of when the Israelites were in the wilderness for 40 years. It's sort of like saying, remember, honey, when we were homeless. Weren't those wonderful days? No, it's remembering when they were wandering in the wilderness and didn't have any place to stay. But it's kind of a nice remembrance because you actually do have a place to stay and you're just doing this for fun. So it is sort of like our camping, right? I mean, why do we go camping? It's kind of silly. Why on earth would you live like a refugee for a week? Refugees don't want to go camping. They want houses. But we go camping. Well, this is what the Israelites do during the Feast of Tabernacles. And so it's a remembrance of the wilderness, but it's also a harvest festival. It's also rejoicing in what God is giving you in the harvest. And so it is a time, it's a festival of huge joy. Now, when there was a temple in Jerusalem, there were two rituals that went with the Feast of Tabernacles. One, the first, was called the water drawing ritual. And what would happen was this. The high priest would go with a procession to the pool of Siloam. He would take a golden flagon of water from the pool of Siloam. He would go in this procession with everybody behind him with palm fronds and branches and all this kind of thing, and he would go to what was called the water gate. At the water gate, a choir would sing Psalms 113 to 118 in their entirety. Right? At Psalm 118, everybody who is gathered would shout, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good," which is the great refrain of Psalm 118, beginning and end of it, and the water would be poured out as this offering to God. And there's one of the rabbis in history that says, if you have not witnessed the joy of the water drawing, you don't know what joy is. This was one of these great, joyous festivals of the year. Second part of it was every night you gather at the temple and there's this ceremony to light huge lamps, four huge, massive lanterns that you pour oil into and then light them, and you could see them all over the city of Jerusalem. Amazing, right? So it's this harvest festival of great joy. It's a celebration of the wilderness wanderings. There's a third reason. There's a third purpose behind it, and we read about it in the book of Zechariah. If you turn to Zechariah chapter 14, Zechariah chapter 14, verse 16. Then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And it goes on from there to talk about even the enemies of Israel will have to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. If they don't, they'll be in trouble. Right? The Feast of Tabernacles is a mark of the Messiah's kingdom. This is the kingdom that is to come, and what will it be marked by? It'll be marked by the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. You know what? Jesus knows about Zechariah. Jesus knows what the Feast of Tabernacles is about. How do we know that? Read in the Gospel of John, chapters 7 and 8. Chapter 7 and 8 of the Gospel of John all take place during the Feast of Tabernacles. And in chapter 7, verse 37, it says, on the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus gets up and says, "Come to me, everyone who is thirsty, and drink." Why? It's the water drawing ceremony. And then the next chapter, chapter 8, verse 12, he gets up and says loudly, "I am the light of the world." Why? It's the ceremony for the lighting of the lamps in the temple. And what is he saying? He's saying, the Feast of Tabernacles is about me. It has come. This is the celebration of the coming kingdom of the Messiah, and the Messiah is here. Jesus knows this. John, writing the Gospel of John, obviously knows it. He makes it a centerpiece of his book. Luke knows it. I think Peter didn't know this. Peter knew this. Peter knew about the Feast of Tabernacles. He was a lot less clueless than we think, right? So let's put together, let's put in a list what Peter knows coming to the end of the Transfiguration. He knows that the Feast of Tabernacles is a celebration of the coming of the Messiah. It is the Messianic kingdom that's here. He knows that's what it's about, and he knows this is right now the Feast of Tabernacles. He knows that he's on a mountain, and everyone knows that everything important happens on mountains, right? Isaac's binding and the sacrifice happens on a mountain, Mount Zion, right? Moses, the giving of the law and the coming down of God's presence to the people of Israel happens on a mountain, Mount Sinai. Elijah on Mount Carmel battling with the prophets of Baal, it happens on a mountain. And later on, not too long afterwards, where is it that Elijah has God revealing himself to him? It's on another mountain, right? Everything good happens on mountains. So they're on a mountain with Jesus' inner circle. It's the Feast of Tabernacles. What else does he know? Well, he knows that Elijah's there. Elijah arrives, right? Everyone knows that Elijah's coming precedes the dawn of the Messianic kingdom. And just as an added bonus, you get Moses too. And we just read that wonderful passage that said there's never been a prophet like Moses. Well, here's the prophet like Moses, and Moses here to confirm it, right? So you get Elijah, you get Moses, you get the Feast of Tabernacles, you're on a mountain, and then you'll get a cloud. Everybody knows what clouds are, right? They're not just these fluffy things up in the sky. When the cloud descends, it's God's presence. It was God's presence in the wilderness for the people of Israel. They're led by the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire at night. It's God's presence that comes down on Mount Sinai. And on Mount Sinai, it's not just, you know, these aren't just your friendly, fluffy clouds, by the way. It's lightning, it's thunder, it's the cloud you do not want to fly into in an airplane, right? That's the kind of cloud we're talking about at Mount Sinai. And here we have, oh, and also, when the tabernacle is dedicated, how is God's presence shown to come down? Cloud descends on it. When Jesus, later on in his ministry, ascends, where does he disappear into? A cloud. The cloud is God's presence. It is the premier symbol of God's presence coming down to earth. So we have the cloud, we have the tabernacles, we have Elijah, we have Moses. And you hardly need this sort of blinding light coming from the man who was your rabbi, right? And you put all this together, and it is not very subtle. It would take someone more clueless than Peter to miss all of this. Peter doesn't miss it. When he says, let's build booths, let's build tabernacles, it all fits, right? He's saying, let's get on with this. The Messianic kingdom is here. So why, in that case, is Luke embarrassed by him? And he is, because he has to make an excuse for him, right? He says he didn't know what he was saying. And Mark, if you look at Mark's account, he's even more embarrassed by him than Luke is, right? And Mark is writing from Peter's perspective, right? So something's wrong here, right? What is it that Peter got wrong? What is it that's missing? I have no idea. I have no idea what he got wrong. Because the best commentators that I read have no idea what he got wrong. They try their explanations. Commentators have to do that. It's their job, right? They have to sell their commentaries. But nobody really knows what he got wrong. I don't know. But I think we can at least ask this. What would an appropriate response have been? What would an appropriate response have been to the unveiling of the glory of the Son of God? And what would be a proper response? What would be an adequate response to that? So I was thinking about a question somewhat similar to this a while ago. Okay, here's the token Turkey part of the sermon. In Turkey, in Istanbul, and I was sitting by the Bosphorus, right? And sitting by the Bosphorus is something that is wonderful. You know, you sit by the Bosphorus and you look out at the view, and we're on the Asian side, and so you look across and you see the Hagia Sophia across from you, and you see, you know, it's just gorgeous, and especially at night. So a summer night, the lights sparkling on the water, and if you're lucky, you know, if the pollution isn't too bad, you look up and you see stars. So I'm sitting by the Bosphorus, I'm drinking a cup of tea, I look up, I see a handful of stars, not all that many, but my mind wanders, and I think, how many stars are there up there? And, you know, so later on I look it up, and, you know, there's a mere 30 billion trillion stars out there, in best estimate, best guess, 350 billion galaxies, best guess. That's a lot, you know? I mean, it's pretty big. That's a lot of stars, a lot of galaxies. So, you know, a little bit too much for my little mind. So I look across, and I see the Hagia Sophia. And I say, oh, well, actually, you know, we've taken enough people on tours, and I listened to my wife, who's the great tour guide, so I know how old it is. It's about 1,500 years old, right? I've been there. In other words, for 1,500 years, somebody could have been sitting where I was and would have seen the same thing. That's pretty amazing. And then you go back 3,000 years before, and the Great Pyramid of Giza was built. 3,000 years before that, the span of human history, you know, it's small compared to the universe and the stars, but it's still pretty massive compared to us, right? So you're pretty overwhelmed. And then you think, well, okay, let's look at something closer at hand. And there are always fishermen around on the Bosphorus. It's really nice. You know, they fish day and night all the time. And there's a fisherman. So I wonder, okay, how many fish are there in the sea? I looked this up too. No one knows. No one has any idea how many fish there are in the sea, but they do know that in the last year, I think 2014 maybe, they concluded there are 10 times more. 10 times more than what? Who knows? 10 times more than they thought before, and nobody knew how many there were before. But the other interesting thing is that 90% of them, 90% of the life in the ocean is below where we have any contact with. That's pretty amazing in itself. So you put all this together and then ask this question, which I was asking for another sermon, but it's worthwhile putting it in this one, and ask, who made all this? Who made all this? A carpenter from Nazareth? Jesus? A rabbi teaching fishermen? He was the one who made all this. We read that in Colossians, right? He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, and everything was created by him and for him. He is the one who made it, and it was made for him. He's the one who holds it all together. You start to get a little bit of a picture of the glory of the Messiah, more glorious than the galaxies that we see and before them and will be after them, right? Spanning far more than human history, spanning the, and this is the man This is the person whose glory is unveiled on the Mount of Transfiguration. That's pretty amazing. What's an adequate response to this? Now, Peter didn't know all of this. You know, this is a little bit too early for him to have put all of it together. He knew a lot, but he didn't know all of that, right? But we do. We do. We know it. What's an adequate response to the unveiling of the glory of the Messiah? When we get it into our heads who he really is, what's an adequate response to that? Well, how do we respond? We organize worship services. You know? And that's good. I like worship services. You know, I don't know. I might be in a minority. I really like worship services. I really like sermons. And I know I'm a minority there, right? But, you know, I like worship services. I like singing Days of Elijah. I like that song, right? It's a good song. It arouses good emotions in me. Isn't it an adequate response? You know? But we come, so we organize worship services, we sit in neat rows, we sing songs, right? We have announcements. Is this an adequate response? This isn't near an adequate response, right? I mean, yeah, we do it, and we're not wrong to do it, and I like doing it, but is it really an adequate response to the unveiling, to the knowledge of who it is that has been revealed to us? And we think, well, you know, it's a little bit different for us. I mean, Peter's up on a mountain, right? Mountains are great, and he sees the glory of the Messiah. You know what? The reality is no different for us. It is no different at all for us. And Paul makes this clear in 2 Corinthians chapter 3. He says, the glory that was shown through Moses is nothing compared to the glory of God revealed in the church through his Spirit. The ministry of the Spirit in the church is more glorious than Moses ever experienced or reflected. So we have the presence of the risen Lord with us. We have the Spirit of God within us, among us here. The glory of the Lord is all around us. No, we don't have the flashing light to see it, but the reality is there. God tells us so. How should we respond? What would an adequate, an appropriate response be to this? Back to Luke. Luke chapter 9, verse 35. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son whom I have chosen. Listen to him." Just listen. Just listen to him. That's the response that God calls to his declaration that this is my son, to his revealing of his glory. Just listen to him. And if we listen, what would we hear? Well, he's been talking. Verse 23. Then he said to them, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his very self? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in glory and in the glory of the Father and of the holy angels." Take up your cross and follow me. Take up your cross daily and follow me. There are two dangers here, I see, in thinking about taking up your cross. The first is to trivialize it, right? And our culture does that naturally because we use the cross as a trivial symbol, wear it around necks. Even putting it up in a church in some ways trivializes it because it makes it normal. In the last couple of years, we've had a corrective to that in Syria, with the return of crucifixion as a real thing, right? It really actually hit me very directly when I first heard about that, when I thought crucifixions are actually happening. Now, I know that there are all kinds of really bad ways to die, right? And people are dying in really bad ways all the time. Why was it that I was especially struck, especially moved, hearing that crucifixion was being brought back. And I think it's exactly because we've trivialized the cross, and so it made it real. That is, when we talk about the cross, it is supposed to have shock value, because the cross means real death, real suffering, real martyrdom. Right? That's what it means. It means really being willing to die. And so when 21 Egyptian Christians, they weren't crucified, but when 21 Egyptian Christians are taken out on a beach and are slaughtered, right, then this is taking up their cross. We don't want to trivialize real martyrdom that's happening in the church in the present day. It really is. And we have to not trivialize it. But there's a problem. And the problem is this one little word, take up your cross daily. Daily take up your cross. Now, so that means today. I think if you went out of here and said, well, I really want to take up my cross today, you'd have a really hard time finding anyone to kill you, right, for your faith. I mean, you would have a pretty difficult time. You could go up and ask a few people, but most of them would say, no thanks, not today, you know? And you would, I mean, you could do it with a little bit of work, but it would take a long plane trip. You know, you have to get on a plane and go someplace really dangerous where they like to kill Christians for their faith, but you'd have a hard time here. So how are you supposed to do it here? How are you supposed to take up your cross daily here? Well, that's where we come to our other problem with this. First one is trivialization. The second one is what I'll call the Aunt Mildred problem. I'm sorry if any of you have an Aunt Mildred. It's nothing against her. But Aunt Mildred is a name for a fictional character in childhood sermons. And this fictional character knew exactly what it was to take up her cross daily. It was her rheumatism. Oh, and it was also her neighbor, Ethel, who was a busybody, right? That her rheumatism and her neighbor, Ethel, and her son, Bobby, who doesn't come and visit enough, right? These were the crosses for Mildred. And what were we supposed to think as we heard these kinds of examples? We're supposed to think, silly Mildred, you know? Silly Mildred, she's trivializing the cross. You know, the cross is about really dying, and Mildred isn't really dying. She just sort of feels badly, and this is what taking up her cross is. You know, I'm thinking about this. I think Mildred is entirely right. This is Mildred's cross to bear in this way. The cross is not about suffering for the sake of suffering. Right? Jesus didn't go to the cross to suffer so that he could suffer. That wasn't the point. The cross is about the overflow of the love of God. It is the outpouring of the love of God. When God's love meets sin, the cross results, because love in response to sin is always costly. And infinite love in response to sin will be infinitely costly. And Jesus bore that cost, demonstrating the love of God. The cross is about the love of God. And if the cross is about the love of God, then bearing our cross is something similar. It means that in relation to one another, we are willing to exercise costly love. Mildred is willing, even though she's irritable because of her rheumatism, to show costly love to her neighbor, Ethel. Ethel really is her cross to bear. Really is. And so is the person sitting next to you and in front of you and behind you, and the person you go out and meet who's irritable, who cuts you off in traffic. All of them are your cross to bear, because all of them are opportunities to show God's costly love to other people in ways that are really meaningful, in ways that cost you, because showing love is always costly. It will always be painful. This is, in the life of Stony Brook, a time of great opportunity. It's a transition, and transitions are always times of great opportunity. It's an opportunity that I know you have been taking to talk about the shape of the church, what's important to the church and in the church, to talk about things like home-based fellowships and Christian education, to talk about worship, to talk about all of these things and ask the question, how should we be doing these things, and come together again, right, behind them all. This is an important time of opportunity in the church to do that. Here's the bigger opportunity. Take up your cross daily in relation to each other. Because in the process of thinking about what you like, what you don't like, what you want, what you dream of, the thing that's most likely to be forgotten is the costly love. And that's the mark of the church. The mark of the church is that we bear with one another in love. It's that we show forth the love of Christ, the cross. That's the mark of the Christian and the mark of the church. And all of these other things could dissolve, right? I mean, you could have, you always will have, as every church does, inadequate worship. Worship will always be inadequate. It will never be up to the level that really is appropriate for the Son of God. But he gives you a way. He says, listen, take up your cross and follow me. And I'll accept that as appropriate worship. He says, give your bodies as living sacrifices. I'll accept that as appropriate worship to me. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for this church that you have called, the people that you've called here out of darkness into your wonderful light, people who have been changed and are being changed and transformed by the cross of Jesus. Lord, thank you for your death on our behalf, for your resurrection in power, for your glory revealed. Thank you, Lord, for the hope that you put before us, and thank you for the love that you pour out among us. And I pray, Lord, that that will be the mark of Stony Brook Community Church. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.